From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Almonitor. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, Deputy White House Editor for Politico, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. A second nurse has been diagnosed with Ebola at the Texas hospital that unsuccessfully treated the first Ebola fatality in the United States. American officials concede they inadequately prepared U.S. healthcare workers and facilities to deal with the deadly virus. The Obama administration summoned nearly two dozen top military officials to a meeting outside Washington to discuss the slow-moving campaign against the group that calls itself the Islamic State. Turkey, however, continued to drag its feet on joining the effort to save a Syrian Kurdish town and instead bombed Turkish Kurds who had been aiding their Syrian brethren. High-level nuclear talks in Vienna between the United States and Iran made progress, boosting hopes that a comprehensive long-term agreement can be reached by a November 24th deadline. And in London, the British House of Commons voted 274-12 to recognize a Palestinian state. While the vote was non-binding, Britain's ambassador to Israel said the vote is, quote, a sign of the way the wind is blowing and will continue to blow without any progress towards peace, unquote. Well, we'll start, unusually for us, with a story that is unfolding in the United States, Tom, and that's the Ebola epidemic. We now have several cases in the United States and a lot of worried individuals, schools closing, panic on a cruise ship. What is the latest on Ebola in the United States?
Well, I think the bottom line, Barbara, is it's going to get worse before it gets better. And if we're fortunate, and I suspect we are, there will not be a full-blown outbreak. But it is also very clear that the healthcare officials in Dallas, in the state of Texas, and within the U.S. government have done a very poor job out of the box of containing this. We went from one individual, Mr. Thomas Duncan, now deceased, in a hospital, to two nurses who got it from him, one of whom went on a flight to Cleveland to look for wedding apparel for her own wedding, who now may have infected a couple of hundred individuals on the round-trip flight from Dallas to Cleveland. And now this whole cruise ship thing is talk about something that could really engender panic. If there's an outbreak of Ebola on a cruise ship, that would really change the whole dynamic. Cruise ships are very wonderful for people who can afford those very high prices of sailing, but they are incubators. I was on a cruise ship several months ago, and you were now bombarded with machines saying, don't go any further until you wash your hands, do you do this or that? That would be pretty frightening. The whole thing, I think, has really thrown the American psyche off kilter here. People are not in a panic, but they are quite concerned, and every day another announcement comes out that someone else may be infected or is under quarantine for 21 days. That's really dangerous psychologically. The real problem is, I think, the Centers for Disease Control, which have this sterling record of curing diseases and finding cures for diseases and considered highly professional, has dropped the ball on this. Yeah. And if you go back and see everything the CDC has said and President Obama has said and the Secretary of Health and Human Services has said, it always turns out to be not quite the case. And you get the feeling that the government is not quite on top of this. I mean, it's very rare for a president of the United States to cancel out 3 days worth of political campaigning in a single week, 3 weeks before in a very important election, to stay home and have emergency cabinet meetings and other meetings with senior healthcare officials. And that is a telltale sign, I think.
Yeah, Hillary, I wanted to ask you about the White House response, the frequent briefings that President Obama is giving now and is getting, and whether there might be some impact also on the midterm elections which are coming up and whether that's also a concern.
Well, it definitely doesn't help the Democrats going into midterms in which they already felt they were being weighed down by the president, who has very low approval ratings and has really been dogged by attacks that his not running a competent government. I mean, dating back to last year with the rollout of Obamacare and putting out a website that couldn't be free of bugs and actually service people as it was supposed to. And I think since then, he's really had a specific image problem in the sort of competence and leadership and being in charge of the right administrators, for instance. So you're seeing the head of the CDC come under a lot of fire, but people look, you know, level up to Obama and say, well, should you remove this guy? You know, how do you not have the right people in place? That kind of thing. It got to a point where Obama realized that the political value of him being on the campaign trail was actually considerably less than being at the White House, being seen as dealing with this issue. So yeah, he missed a couple fundraisers, you know, rally, political events like that. But he was able, you know, to say, look, I'm at the White House and I'm taking care of this issue. I think the decision was also informed by the fact that over the summer and a couple of other notable cases, there was criticism about him making a statement about the death of Americans at the hands of the Islamic State and then going to play golf while on vacation. And I think the White House, they're very aware of the optics and they don't want Obama out making a statement or meeting with advisors on a bowl in the morning and then going and, you know, rallying people about political issues in the afternoon. I think there's also a question of the role of the president at this moment and the actual issues of making the situation better go back again to the CDC and the actual hospitals and the, you know, health workers that are involved. But when it comes to the issue of panic and how the sort of broad American population relates to what's happening, the president is the most effective person to reach that population, to calm them down because so many of the fears are incredibly misplaced. Also to get people to take the appropriate precautions, that there's a role for that type of leadership. And it hasn't been exercised until now. You've seen a lot of different statements, many of which have been wrong, coming out from lower levels. And so the White House has an opportunity here to use Obama effectively. I don't know that people perceive him as having done that. And so I think if they don't get that right, it will only, you know, intensify the bad political climate around Obama. And, you know, you're not going to see a good turnout for Democrats at the polls coming off of this. So,
Tom, it still seems incredible to me that the U.S. Government was not able to give the proper information to the one hospital in the United States, outside four specialized hospitals that have special facilities for this sort of thing, was not able to give them proper advice or transfer the patient or do something. I mean, there's a group, Doctors Without Borders, that does this routinely now in the epicenter of the epidemic. They could have provided some advice if the CDC wasn't able to. How could this have been allowed to happen? This is a major hospital, Texas Presbyterian. It's a hospital that had a very good reputation until all of this began.
And it did have a very good reputation. I am almost certain, I hope listeners will not have to correct me, but I'm almost certain that former President George W. Bush has had some surgical procedures at Texas Presbyterian Hospital. And you're right, it is a very well-known and highly regarded hospital in Dallas. But this unfortunate chain of events begins with Texas Presbyterian. When Mr. Duncan, now dead, first came in with troublesome symptoms, he was sent home. Yeah. And only when he got worse and was brought back did it become clear that he had Ebola and had to be quarantined, but then it was too late. But I want to go back to what Hillary said, because I agree with it totally. When you have a situation where the average American is saying, what is going on here? How did this happen? Why is it not getting fixed? That's never good for politicians, and especially never good for incumbents. And when you have a president as unpopular as President Obama is right now, a very prominent Democratic consultant with very close ties to the White House said to me the other day that he's not just unpopular, he's super unpopular. That makes it more difficult to assert and project the moral authority really needed in a situation like this to calm people down. I mean, whatever else I believe or don't believe, I absolutely believe that the chances of an epidemic in this country are extremely low. But I don't think a lot of Americans are as comfortable with that after this whole chain of events where something happens and then it gets worse and then there's a cruise ship and then there's airplane yeah. flights. And it makes people nervous. And while the president, I agree with Hillary, is the appropriate messenger, he may be the wrong messenger at this point.
And I think that this issue of credibility and trust is really crucial, because the situation has gotten to where it is in terms of Americans being so out of joint about it because there were messages that said, don't worry,
right,
it's going to be okay. And now there are big questions about what's going on. And I think that, you know, again, there are, you know, issues about Obama's specific credibility, and his numbers in terms of how Americans not trusting him have been pretty bad. So this feeds into a narrative that's already out there. And I think that's when things get really bad for politicians, is when external events are seen through a lens that confirms sort of the worst view that people are already inclined to have about them. And to your question about the, you know, Doctors Without Borders versus people in a Texas hospital, I think, I mean, it's obvious that there were major breaches at this hospital, which are pretty unforgivable in the circumstances. But I also think it's worth keeping in mind that Doctors Without Borders is an organization. They might be nonprofit, extended, in the worst conditions, but they are people who are doing this day in and day out. They know exactly what the protocols are. This is something they're extremely familiar with. And there's just no substitute for having experience when you're dealing with these kinds of things. And a Texas hospital has never dealt with this before. And it's sort of not surprising on some level that there were going to be mistakes, and the first time you're dealing with this highly dangerous and no mistakes allowed environment. And I think that's actually one of the big problems, was that the CDC said, hey, all the hospitals have these facilities, they know the protocols, and they can all handle it. Well, it's not enough to sort of have the equipment, have the protocols. You have to have people who can execute them. And since there are some facilities in America that do have this specific training, those are the best places. That's where people have to be. And that's why you've seen the nurses that are affected transferred to those places, where I think there's a lot more confidence, getting back to the trust issue. That they're going to be not only getting the best care, but also the most protection will be taken and precautions in terms of the rest of the people that come into contact
and
with them.
And in fact, there have been Americans who were infected in Liberia who came back and were successfully treated, and there was no transmission of the disease to any healthcare workers in those facilities. So perhaps that'll be the pattern going forward, and we just have to hope that there aren't more infections that came out of this Duncan case and the sort of, you know, spreading the ripples of the pond going out from those who were in contact with people who were treating Duncan. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of All Monitor. Joining me today are Tom DeFrank of National Journal and Hillary Krieger of Politico. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Tom, you had another thought on Ebola before we move on?
Very quickly. I think of all the incredible bungles here, the one that might have been the most not so much egregious, but the one that was helped destroy public confidence, was the earlier one where the second nurse from Texas Presbyterian Hospital went off to Cleveland on an airplane, and the CDC has said she should never have been allowed to travel. Well, it later turned out that she called the CDC because she had a mild fever, and she was not told to cancel her trip. The American people, or most people, are not stupid. And when you see something like that, you just kind of hold your head and say, what is going on here? And that is, as I said earlier, that's never a good thing for the government, especially 2.5 weeks before an election.
Indeed, indeed. We're going to move on to another area where the administration's competence has been questioned, Hillary, and that is the coalition against the group calling itself the Islamic State. It's been some weeks now. The administration claims that there are more than 20 countries that are part of this coalition. There is a continuation of bombing of various sites in Iraq and also the Syrian Kurdish town of Kobani, which, as we are speaking, is still hanging on by a thread. Various reports of advances in Anbar province on the part of IS getting very, very close to Baghdad, which is indeed worrisome. What's your sense of how the campaign is going? How unified this coalition is? Can we really call it a coalition?
I think that the fact that the U.S. has been able to get Arab partners on board who have never wanted to be involved in any sort of military engagement in general, it's not, the Saudis are not usually out there flying all the nice, highly advanced aircraft that the U.S. is always sending them. The fact that they're willing to actually take any military steps, and that it's, you know, publicly with the United States, I don't think that's a small thing. I think it's fair for the United States to call that a coalition. I think it's also You know, strategically, if the U.S. can use that for mileage, whether it's the message that it sends to the region about the extent of opposition to the Islamic State, whether it's an important message for Congress to say that something is being done here and we are able to achieve, you know, considerable diplomatic success. So there's reason to see that we have a strategy going forward. I think that that's a fair point for them to emphasize and even overemphasize, because all governments do that, right? They use the situation and the rhetoric that they can for their advantage. But that can be good in terms of perception. It can be good in terms of getting momentum. It doesn't necessarily affect the situation on the ground. And the airstrikes that the U.S. has engaged in are just of limited effect. And, you know, there's been a real conflict in the White House about feeling that they have to do something, that the situation has reached a level where they couldn't simply stand back from the fray, which is essentially what they've done until now, but a deep, deep unwillingness to go beyond airstrikes where you're really likely to see American lives at risk. And that unwillingness has been so clear that they've made repeated statements about not having American boots on the ground, which really limits what they can do in the situation and even what they can project. You know, it limits their ability to threaten that.
Sure.
And so that, I think, you know, is also part of why, when it comes to what's happening on the ground, there hasn't been the real success that certainly the White House would have liked to see right out of the box.
I must admit, Barbara, to a certain deja vu here. As a young Army public affairs officer assigned to the Pentagon in 1968, 69, and 70, one of my jobs was to come in early and read all the reports from Vietnam about how well things were going. And there were statistic after metric showing that the military effort by the U.S. command was doing very well. And they had, you know, 300 sorties yesterday, and they blew up this many tons of ammunition. And this kept going on, and the situation was not necessarily getting better. I've seen this movie before. That's what you see here. The Pentagon every day is saying, well, we flew 37 missions yesterday, and there were five members of our coalition participating in airstrikes. But the real problem is the ground component. And to his credit, President Obama has talked about that. But the U.S. government now has money to train 5,000 moderate anti-ISIS, anti-Assad troops in Syria, train them in Saudi Arabia, but everybody says it's going to take at least a year to get them ready. And so I wouldn't call the coalition strikes pinpricks, but it's pretty clear they're not at the moment, at least they're not altering the fundamental reality on the ground.
Yeah. Well, Hillary, the gaping hole in this is that there really is not a confluence of interest in terms of what happens in Syria. Members of the coalition have very, very different views. The Iraqi government wants the Assad regime to stay in power. Mm-hmm. Iran, which is backing both those governments, wants Assad to stay in power. Turkey wants Assad to fall. And Turkey also has its own complicated relationship with the Kurds, which has kept the Turks from actually aiding the United States in going, and the rest of the coalition, in going after the Islamic State in this town of Kobani. Instead bombed the PKK, which is a Kurdish organization that has had been having peace talks with the Turks, and I thought fairly successfully. So it's quite confusing as to what the next step is in this. And with that lack of clarity, can you really have a success?
Right, and I think the biggest lack of clarity is on the American side. I mean, the administration, Obama has said several times that Assad must go, but hasn't put in place anything that really advances that effort. And so if the United States, as the leader of this coalition and as the superpower that's in the world, I think had a sense of this goal is the number one goal to us and this is what we're going to do, I think the entire scope of the conflict would change. It wouldn't necessarily be successful, but it would go a long way towards sort of putting in place an overriding, you know, strategy and framework. And instead, the U.S. has said, well, the Islamic State is really bad. We have to stop that.
That's the first priority, and it's really not clear what happens after,
right,
is it?
But exactly, because while they've been saying that Assad must go, by going after the Islamic State, they're actually helping Assad. So
exactly.
Assad has been sort of supportive of what the United States is doing, which is a total jumble. So it's not surprising that the lesser powers are then seeing a pie that they can carve up for themselves, which only adds to the chaos.
Yeah. I'm going to just briefly touch on one area where there was some progress this week, Tom, and that is in the talks with Iran. John Kerry had marathon negotiations with his Iranian counterpart, Javad Zarif, in Vienna, and the noises coming out were more positive than I've heard in a while. There's a deadline of November 24th to get an agreement, and we're hearing not that they're talking about another extension, but they're talking about actually trying to meet that deadline. If the Obama administration were able to get this nuclear deal, that might help change the narrative a little bit.
Yes, I think that's so. And it's hard to know whether they can get a modified deal or a comprehensive deal. I know the U.S. would like a comprehensive deal, but I think if the negotiators could work out an arrangement which limits the amount of nuclear development, centrifuge development that the Iranians could do in exchange for some lifting or easing of some of the sanctions, that would be progress. Of course, there are cynics, mainly political, who say the Iranians have this president's number and they're slow walking, and by November 18th, it's going to be clear they need another extension. And we may be wrong about that. If in fact, even a half a loaf agreement is reached by November 24th, that is significant progress. And you have to suspect that the Iranians may be more amenable to something for the obvious reason that oil prices are plummeting around the world, and that's hurting Vladimir Putin in Russia. That's hurting the fledgling Iraqi government, but it's also hurting Iran, which is suffering already under severe sanctions, and now are faced with the prospect of declining oil revenue. So it's probably more urgent for Iran than ever before to get to the table if they can get some sanctions eased.
Yeah, Hillary, some of the reports coming out of Vienna suggest actually an old formula that was discussed back in 2009, that Iran would be able to keep the centrifuges that it has going but send out the stockpiles of enriched uranium possibly to Russia. So the way the administration is talking about it is that there are a lot of different pathways to ensure that Iran cannot break out and develop a nuclear weapon quickly without anybody being able to take action. We're getting close to the end of the time, and I wanted to turn to one last topic on which I think you are an expert, and that is this question of the Palestinian state. Now, as we all know, the peace talks that the U.S. had been moderating collapsed last spring. We had this terrible war in Gaza, and now we see the Palestinians are moving toward trying to get a UN Security Council resolution declaring that there will be a Palestinian state by the end of 2015 or beginning of 2016. And we see individual governments taking action. The Swedes have said they would recognize a Palestinian state. And then there was this vote in the British House of Commons. Are we moving toward a situation where the Palestinians are going to get their state, at least theoretically, through UN and other action?
And I think that there's certainly some movement on the ground towards that. It's not really clear what that means in practice. The PLO, for instance, has gotten a lot of recognition from well over 100 countries over the year, and that has translated into absolutely nothing on the ground. So not that the British House of Commons is the same as, mm-hmm. you know, that
the exact assembly.
But, you know, we've seen a lot of these types of external diplomatic recognitions or other types of procedures that might seem in a sort of international scope to be very significant in terms of where world powers stand on these issues. But what matters the most is really what happens on the ground. Israel has control over these areas. So that, I think, is a very open question how much that really is going to change the dynamic. But also, we haven't seen a real strong U.S. response yet. And I think when it hits the U.N. Security Council, which is actually a body that has a lot more power and the force of international law than General Assembly resolutions and sort of individual countries extending possibilities of recognition, which, of course, the British House of Commons wasn't. It was simply symbolic. The U.S., I think, is very likely to step in. And they have said many times that they see these moves by the Palestinians, they call them unilateral moves, they see them as unhelpful. They've vetoed other resolutions that the Palestinians have brought forward. So in terms of the bodies that actually have more impact on what's really going to be happening in terms of, you know, how these groups are reacting and acting in the region. I think that that's where the U.S. tends to play a role, and that's mm-hmm. probably going to be pretty negative in terms of where the Palestinians would like to see it going.
Tom, should the Israelis be worried, though, about what this vote indicates in terms of sentiment toward Israel in Europe?
Well, I think they should be, but this is an old story as well, Barbara. I mean, more than one president in recent years from both political parties has privately said that the United Nations is a hotbed of Palestinian sentiment. And so UN resolutions, I don't think, should necessarily worry the Israelis, except the British vote is yet another psychological indication that there is some momentum here. I don't think it goes anywhere as a practical matter, because peace has got to be sorted out on the ground, not within the UN General Assembly. But it's worrisome, but I don't think it's a decisive development.
Hillary, one last question. Do you think it puts any pressure on Netanyahu to go back to peace talks, to try to head off these moves at the UN?
Israelis, they're pulled two ways. One, they very much want to be part of the West. They see Europe as their natural home, not the Middle East. And it does make a difference when you're talking about Western Europe and Britain, a close ally, you know, to the extent that Israel has allies aside from the U.S. and Canada. The fact that they, you know, there are so many people taking this type of move, you know, it is rattling to Israelis. There's no question about it. But there's another pull, which is the nobody can take care of us except ourselves. You know, we've faced over the years so much international criticism. And after the war this summer, where, you know, from the Israeli perspective, they were being rocketed in their homes. They had made many overtures to try and not get into a war that wasn't where sentiment was. And yet the entire world condemned Israel for reacting. So there's a much more of a siege mentality. And this sort of adds to that. So it could also stiffen Israeli resolve and make things harder.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, Deputy White House Editor for Politico, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Curtis Bynum. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.